Acts chapter 17 is where we'll be this morning. We're going to begin our study this month on God. And it's kind of an intimidating study to me. But it's really the very first of the first principles. It's the most fundamental of all things. And so we need to study about Him. And I was talking to Monica on the way and thinking, you know, as we were driving here, how much I need to think about Him more, because when we live in a world like we do, we can become so consumed with the things that we see that it's very hard to keep in focus the thing that's most important that we can't see, literally. And so we need to work constantly on enlarging Him in our minds, seeing Him, and I hope that we can do a little bit of that this month. There's a statement that was made in 1 John chapter 4 and verse 4 by the Apostle John in his letter. He said, "Greater is He who is in you than he who is in the world. Greater is the Father, greater is the Son, greater is the Holy Spirit who is in you than he who is in the world." I think that's a great thought. And when the Holy Spirit talks to us about the truth about God, He doesn't talk about it in abstract terms and theoretical type format. He puts it, He explains the truth in the lives of people. He shows how that truth operates in the lives of individuals. And he does that when he talks about God. This month, as we think about God and we try to study and think about Jesus and the Holy Spirit and such, I want that to somehow help to change our lives. That's what we're here to do. I can't change your lives, but we need to somehow put ourselves before the Lord and let Him change the way we live. It doesn't do us any good if we think about God, but it doesn't change how we live. All you have to do to see how dramatically it can affect your life, if you will really enlarge Him in your mind, is to look at the people in the Bible who are faithful. Think about the 12 spies. Think about the spies that went into the land. 10 came back, and they said, "They're giants in the land. We can't take it. Forget about it. Let's go back to Egypt." I challenge you to name one of those 10 spies today. The ones we remember are the two, and they came back and said, "Sure, they're giants, but they're not big as our God. We can take the land. Let's take it now." And they went in and they conquered the land. 40 years later, whenever God found a new generation that would believe in Him like those two spies. In other words, you know, we can take, you know, they lived the faith that John expressed in the words, "Greater is He who is in you than he who is in the world." They lived that faith. Moses went to Egypt. He was armed with a shepherd's staff, and he took his brother by his side, and he walked into the courtroom or the throne room of the greatest king on the planet and put his finger in his face and said, "Jehovah said, let my people go." Can you imagine having the courage to do that? And at the end of the 10 judgments of God upon that arrogant king, Moses walked out of Egypt with Israel behind him, and the king was begging them to leave, and the people were giving them presents on the way out. Moses lived the faith that is expressed in the words of John, "Greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world." Somehow we have got to let a study of God change the way we live, or it doesn't do us any good at all. There's a young shepherd boy who was looking for his brothers, and he showed up at the Israelite camp, and across the way was the army of the Philistines. And they had a nuclear weapon, and his name was Goliath of Gath. And every day he would come out, and he was screaming, and he would shout, and he would taunt the Israelites, and they were cowering like a bunch of scared rabbits. But David's attitude, when all of Israel was saying he's too big to kill, David was saying he's too big to miss. And with that conviction of faith in the nature of his God, he gained the victory over the giant. And we need to have the kind of faith as that's expressed in these words, greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. Those are the kind of people that God can accomplish great things with. Not the great, not the sophisticated, not the powerful, not the intellectual of the world, but those who have faith in the Lord that he can work in them and through them to do exceedingly beyond all that they can ask or think. Joshua, Caleb, Moses, David, they lived that faith that was expressed in the words that you see on the screen. And we need to magnify and increase God in our minds so that we can live a faith that's equal to what we're professing with our mouths. And so that God can do in our generation the kind of great things that he did in these other generations. Well, Acts chapter 17 is where I want us just to spend a few minutes this morning, where Paul had arrived in the city of Athens, Greece, and he was in the middle of his second journey, and he was waiting there for his companions, Titus and or Timothy and Silas, to return. He had sent them to Macedonia. And in verse 16 of that chapter, if you'll look in Acts chapter 17 and verse 16, he said, while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was being provoked within him as he was observing a city full of idols. Says that while he waited for these guys to come, he was walking around the city, taking a tour of it, and what he saw made him angry. The word provoked there is the word that means angered. He was steamed. And Athens was a city of idols. We probably all studied that or even seen pictures of that. There were at least 2,000 to 3,000 idols in that city from what people have estimated. One fellow said it was easier to find a god than a man. It was a city of magnificent architecture, great buildings, temples, statues, shrines. You could find those all through the city. It was the cultural and the intellectual city of the Greek world. Do we have cities like that today? What would you think would be the cities in our nation that would be the cultural and intellectual centers of our nation? Luke's commentary on Paul here is that he wasn't impressed. He was provoked by it. It's a word that also was used to describe God's attitude toward idolatry. I want you to go with me just real quickly to Exodus chapter 34. Exodus 34, verse 14 through 16. Because this is the way that God felt about the idolatrous nations around. Exodus chapter 34, verse 14 through 16. He told the Israelites, you shall tear down the altars and smash the pillars and cut down their asherim, for you shall not worship any other god, for the Lord whose name is jealous is a jealous God. Otherwise you may make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they would play the harlot with their gods and sacrifice to their gods, and someone might invite you to eat of his sacrifice. I am a jealous God, and you're not to have anything to do with those foreign gods. And I want to suggest that when Paul walked around the city of Athens, he was jealous for God's glory. And I want to ask, how does it affect you? How does it affect me? How does it affect you when you're in the workplace and you hear how people talk? You hear what they love, what they adore, what really is at the center of their hearts. How does it affect you? Does it provoke you? Does it anger you? Do you feel jealous for the glory of God? Paul's motive that day for preaching, and we're going to read his sermon in just a couple minutes. His motive for preaching that day, I suggest to you, is that his jealousy for God's glory. Now, should we do evangelism because we love souls and we want to save people? Absolutely. That's a vital motive. But I don't think it's the highest motive. I think we should preach and teach others, and the ultimate, highest motive is because of the glory of God. And we should love that, and we should be jealous for the glory of God in this world. In verse 17 it says, he was reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews and with the God-fearing Gentiles, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be present. On Sabbath he was in the synagogues. He went to the Jews because that was the people who should have known God and should have been ready to hear the gospel. But he didn't just work on the Sabbath and take Sunday through Friday off. He spent the rest of the days in the marketplace, and he talked to anybody who would listen to him. Anybody who would hear, he was ready to talk to. And who was the people who were there? Who were in the marketplace that he could talk to? Look at verse 18. And also some of the Epicureans and the Stoic philosophers were conversing with him. There were philosophers that were there. Athens was a philosophical center, home of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle. And then they didn't treat, these fellows didn't treat Paul very respectfully. He says, some were saying, what would this idle babbler wish to say? And others says, he seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities because he was preaching the resurrection. The word there for an idle babbler, in the marginal reading, says one who makes a living picking up scraps. I think literally that referred to somebody who was poor, was kind of a loafer who wandered around the city picking up pieces of food and things he could find. But they applied it to Paul here as somebody who would go around and probably pick up pieces of learning and information. And he kind of put it together and then pawned it off as something that belonged to him. He was trying to sound smart. What is this idle babbler has to say? Did they treat him delicately with kid gloves? Kind of mocked him, didn't they? Kind of made fun of him. And so, what did he preach to him? He said, wow, these are philosophers. These are really intellectuals. I better really adorn this message that I have and kind of dress it up so it'll be impressive to them. He preached the resurrection. It's the same message that he preached in every city. No exception. He was not interested in modifying the message. He didn't need to dress it up for them. I think, from what I read, most Greeks would have rejected the idea of physical resurrection. I think the most desirable condition it was to be beyond the grave where the soul was free from the body. But there wasn't really an afterlife. It was just this idea of being set free. So it was a message that was that would call their attention. It's a message that would challenge them. It's a message that would be in opposition to some of the things they believed. And in verse 19 it says, they took him, and they brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new teaching is which you are proclaiming. For you are bringing some strange things to our ears, so we want to know what these things mean. He was taken to the Areopagus, which was, from what I read, it was the council of the 30 leading citizens. And they had authority over religion and morals in Athens. They were maybe you call them the philosophical thought police. They wanted to make sure what was brought there was maybe orthodox or something that they would accept. And I read that that Socrates was even poisoned for teaching strange things in Athens. Do we have that kind of courage? What I want you to see, even as we're looking at Paul here before we get to his sermon, is that he was living the faith that was expressed by John here, greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. He went into a place that was very intimidating, and people that may have thought they knew a lot and had great ideas, but they were human ideas, and Paul said, I have something that you need to hear. And he talked to them about the resurrection. Do we do that? Do we have that kind of faith and courage? Do we talk to people about the resurrection of Jesus Christ? We need to have a greater picture of God in our minds and in our hearts, so that we have the courage to do what Paul did. So he goes to the Areopagus, and he's brought before these men, and that would be very impressive, important people. And in verse 22, it says that he stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, men of Athens, I observe that you are very religious in all respects. The Areopagus was sometimes translated Mars Hill, or the Hill of Ares, which was the Greek god of war. And he opens his lesson with an introduction here. He said, it's kind of an intention getter. I perceive that you're very religious. From what I understand, the word religious there is sort of flexible. It can be translated superstitious. So it can go either way. So these guys would be saying, did he just compliment us or slap us in the face? You know, kind of, what is he saying here? So he introduces it, calls their attention to him, and then he says in verse 23, while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I also found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. And therefore what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you. If I was to put a title on this lesson today, I would call it Introducing the Unknown God. And that's what we want to think about today, is the unknown God. And maybe these Athenians acknowledged the possibility that there were other gods that they didn't know about. They certainly didn't want to leave any of them out. And they offered sacrifices to this idol, though they didn't seem to have any knowledge about it. But they were willing to acknowledge that it was a possibility there's other gods. And so he was prepared to talk to them about this. And he just, really what he does, he tells them five things about the God that they need to know, that they were ignorant of. And notice the word ignorant there. We'll bring that up again a little bit later. He says, therefore what you worship in ignorance I proclaim to you. And the first thing he mentions, he says in verse 24, the God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, doesn't dwell in temples made with hands. First of all, I want you to notice he talks about God as a creator. He introduces this God as one who is the creator. I think that's significant when it comes to this idea of greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. And Abraham believed and lived the faith that was expressed in this idea, greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. He uprooted himself from his home, just kind of going back and using one illustration in the Old Testament. He uprooted himself from his home. He left everything. He took only his wife and his family. He went out not knowing where he was going, with a promise that God would give him a land and make him a nation from his own seed. And it was amazing because his wife was barren. And she stayed that way for at least 25 years as he lived in the land. He was still waiting. How could he live like that? How could he live in the land for 25 years expecting a child from a wife who had been barren for all those years? Real quickly, I want to read a verse over in Romans. Just turn a few pages over to Romans chapter 4 and verse 17. So I just think that Abraham had to live the faith that was expressed in those words. And God being the creator was a significant part of that. Look in chapter 4 and verse 17. Paul says, it is written, a father, this is what God said to Abraham, a father of many nations I have made you. In the presence of him whom he believed, even God who gives life to the dead and calls into being that which does not exist. How could Abraham live believing that and doing the things that demonstrated that faith that God would give him a child? Because if God was able to produce life from nothing, he could produce life from the barrenness of Sarah's womb. Nobody had ever seen God do that miracle before. But he knew that this God created the world, and he knew he could bring life to Sarah. How could the Apostle Paul uproot himself and travel 2,800 miles in uncharted territory and go to Corinth and Athens and be stoned and shipwrecked and mocked and rejected? Because this is the God that made the world and all things in it. If he could raise Jesus from the dead, he could raise Paul up from the dead. How can we uproot ourselves and untangle ourselves from this world and walk after Jesus, even in uncharted territory with odds against us? How can we live with this idea, greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world? Because this is a God who made the world and all things in it. And that's a practical point about God, that he's the creator. And it means something to us in our lives and how we live them. But Paul had another point to make about God. Look back in chapter 17 of Acts again. He said that this God who made the world and all things in it, since he's the Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he served with human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. Here he talks about God as the sustainer. This God that Paul was introducing to them was self-sustained. The Athenians emphasized what the worshiper did for God. But Paul would emphasize what the God did for the worshiper. The Athenians, evidently, after their festivals, would leave food out for their gods to eat, as though they were somehow sustaining him. I think it's not easy to live among idolaters and not think like idolaters. I think we probably do that to some degree. Israel fell into that trap. Look with me just real quick back to Psalm 50, the 50th Psalm. Verse 8 through 15. God said, He said, I am your God. I do not reprove you for your sacrifices and your burnt offerings are continually before me. But I shall take no young bull out of your house, nor male goats out of your folds. For every beast of the field is mine, and the cattle on 1,000 hills. I know every bird of the mountains, and everything that moves in the field is mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine and all it contains. Shall I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of goats? Offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving and pay your vows to the Most High and call upon me in the day of trouble, and I shall rescue you and you will honor me. We don't provide for God. He provides for us. He says, I'm not asking you for these sacrifices because I'm hungry and I need them. I'm allowing you to offer these things for me out of thanksgiving and gratitude for how I've rescued you and delivered you. He says, you call upon me in the day of need, and I will rescue you. We don't sustain God. He sustains us. Look a little bit further to Psalm 104. I like to... this is a beautiful psalm. It talks about that God is the sustainer and provider in this world. Psalm 104, verse 10 and 11. He said, He sends forth springs in the valleys, and they flow between the mountains. They give drink to every beast of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. Beside them the birds of the heavens dwell. They lift up their voices among the branches. He waters the mountains from His upper chambers, and the earth is satisfied with the fruit of His works. Look at verse 14. He causes the grass to grow for the cattle, and vegetation for the labor of man, so that he may bring forth food from the earth. We plant, but God makes it grow. And as Paul takes it beyond that here, when he says in verse 25, he is not served by human hands, though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. Every breath he takes because he gives it. That's the point. Do we ever stop and contemplate that? I rarely do. But boy, we should. It's not, we act sometimes like we sustain ourselves. It's very hard to get our minds wrapped around the idea of how dependent we are on God, and furthermore, how much He wants to care for us. Isn't it kind of hard sometimes for a parent when a child gets older and he acts as though he's self-sustaining and he hasn't got a clue how many things that parent is providing for him every day? And the parents, we just kind of shake our heads, knowing that one day they'll perceive it, but you couldn't convince them at that moment. And how many times does God shake His head at us? Just shakes His head, because we just think that somehow we are self-sustaining. We are self-sufficient. And we have this economic crisis that we've got going right now, and there's a lot of smart people out there that's trying to bail us out of it. And they'll probably come up with something. We'll sing our praises because we are able to do that. But, for Christians, he doesn't need to worry, because greater is He who is in you than he who is in the world. Jesus said, are not two sparrows sold for a cent? And yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father, but the very hairs of your head are all numbered. We need to have that kind of understanding of the greatness of God and His desire to sustain us and provide for us in difficult times. But Paul also said that He is also the ruler of all things. Verse 26, and He made from one man every nation to live upon the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. Who is it that has their finger on the nuclear weapons of the world? Somebody had a book about that. God does. Goliath was the nuclear weapon of the Philistines, and God disarmed him with a shepherd boy. Nebuchadnezzar was a nuclear weapon, and he was reduced to the realm, to a beast of the field, eating grass that was drenched with dew, until he recognized that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows upon it whoever he wishes. Nations don't expand their borders because they have the power to do it, but because God permits it. That's what the Bible says. He decides how much territory a given nation will have. Jeremiah 10, we won't go there, but he tells Israel, he says, I'm the potter, and you're the clay, and I formed you, and I'm the sovereign ruler, and the only reason you're on the map is because I decided it. And if you don't behave yourself, I'll take you off the map. That's what he told them. God is the one who rises up nations, gives rise to nations, and takes them there. Why does he do that? Why does he govern the world in the way that he does? Why raise up a nation and then let it fall? Why order the limitations and boundaries of our creation, of his creation? Look at verse 27. That they might seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him. That they might seek God. He has a purpose in what he does. He's a father. That they would seek God, if perhaps they may grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. God is the one who is the ruler over the nations. He is the father of all human beings. He's not talking about fatherhood here in the sense that we think about as a spiritual father of Christians, but the creator of, he created all humanity in his own image. He made from one man all. Paul makes his point here. If we're made by him, look if you would a little bit further. I didn't read the rest of this. Look in verse 29. Being then the children of God, we ought not think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone or an image formed by the art and the thought of man. If you're created by him, you know, made by him, then why think of him as some animal or a piece of stone or something inanimate? Idolatry is illogical when you worship the real God. If you're created by a living God, why worship something that's not living? I think men are worshiping people, creatures. I think we're made to worship something. And all you have to do is listen to people's conversations and see if they worship Wall Street or their jobs or their ideas or their football team. We adore things. We talk about things in glorious, majestic terms, and rarely do we talk about God. Rarely do we exalt him and talk about him in those terms. We talk about other things that we admire. We are going to worship something. And the sad thing is we create gods, we create things, and then we worship the very things that we create. And that's what the Athenians did. They created their gods, they shaped them, and they filled their towns, and then they turned and they worshiped the things that they created. And he said, that's so illogical. That would have had to be very repulsive to a Jew. A Jew who always believed in the one true living God, and he sees all these people bowing down to stones and idols and such. So he's the father of all the world, the creator of the world. And he's also, he says that finally, he's the judge of the world. Verse 30 and 31. Paul says, therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to all men that all people everywhere should repent. Because he's fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead. This idea of overlooking the times of ignorance, I think, is interesting. Because if you compare the nations with Israel, you have really two different situations. Because in the Old Testament, God chose Abraham and he spoke to him, and he took that... Abraham raised up a nation and took him to Mount Sinai, and he spoke to them through Moses and through his prophets, and he gave them oracles to live by, and he gave him all of his laws. Now, frequently, Israel would leave those laws, and he would wander around and stumble around in the darkness, but he had it. He had the light there to know how to serve the Lord. But the nations didn't have that privilege. The nation, now, and there may be like small occasions where maybe Jonah would go to Nineveh, or maybe another time or two, but by and large, the nations didn't have the oracles of God. They were ignorant. They were like blind men fumbling around, groping. When I saw that word there, it made me think about blind people or those who are in the dark. When he says, go back up a little bit to verse 27, when he says that they would seek God if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he's not far from each one of us. I think that plays into this idea of ignorance. Here are these people and they're groping, they're wandering around and blindly looking for something, but they can't find it. And think about how ironic that is, that here are some of the most intellectual people in the world, the greatest philosophers of all time, and they're in the city of Athens, and they can't find the Lord. They just can't find him. I think it's the epitome of human, intelligence here in the city, but it's the fallacy of what happens when you don't have the revelation of God. When you're trying to find your way without God's revelation. You wander around groping in the dark, you'll never find it. And Paul here has, he's saying the times of ignorance have passed. The time's up. No more ignorance. But now God has made that revelation available to all men. And he's done it through his Son, Jesus Christ. And he talks about this God who was the creator and the sustainer and the ruler and the father. But now that he's provided this revelation for every man, so that there's no excuse to stay in the darkness, he says now he's ready to be the judge. And so he says here, he has fixed today. The world's judgment is universal. It is the world that will be judged, every human being. And it will be righteous. It will be injustice. He will be the judge. He will judge injustice. And he will judge definitely. It is a certain thing. He's even actually picked a day. And a day has been fixed. And then the identity of the judge has been established. It's the one who came and lived here among us, who died and rose again. And the resurrection is the testimony that he truly is the one. Somebody says he didn't preach the crucifixion. He just preached resurrection. Well, if you're raised, I think it presupposes you probably died. I don't think this is the whole sermon. You're probably glad of that, because you've been here a while, there was more to it. But he gave us a synopsis of what he told those people that day. That there's this God who is the real God, who is the true and living God, is going to judge the world in righteousness. Well, this is a pretty comprehensive study of God that Paul does. It's not like a fire escape policy where he just gives you he says, just do this and you'll be fine. Sometimes I think we're in such a hurry. That's what we want to do to people. We just want to give them the facts. Just give them some basics. Here's what you need to be saved and you'll be fine. And Paul doesn't do that. He gets down to the fundamental basic principle of where they had went wrong. He speaks of God in all his aspects. Creator, sustainer, ruler, father, coming as a judge in the person of his son. It's the full gospel and it's about God. And this text shows how empty life is without God. Here's a city full of idols and shrines and temples, and a city whose academia was thought highly throughout the world. And even today, people still study the documents of that the Greeks. But for Paul, he summed it all up in one word: ignorance. Ignorance. Let's look at one last passage. Look in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Verse 18. For the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside. Where is the wise man? Verse 20 says. Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For indeed, Jews ask for signs, and Greeks search for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block, and to the Gentiles foolishness. But to those who are the called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God, and the wisdom of God. Could you have done that on that day? Could you have done what Paul did? Do we have the faith that's expressed in the words of John, greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world? Paul didn't have everybody come forward that day. He had about two, maybe a few more. One of them was on the council. One of them was one of the 30 citizens that sat in judgment on him. It says in verse 34 of that chapter, some men joined him and believed. Among those were Dionysus the Areopagite and a woman named Demarius and others with them. So maybe not too many, but he found a few that day. Because he believed, greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. We need to believe in the power of God and the power of his word and how it can change us. Do you do that? Today we invite you to worship this God. And I hope that as we study this week, that we'll, in this month, try to focus a little bit more on God and some of his, who he is and his character, and that it will somehow enlarge our vision of him, cause us to behave ourselves in a way that demonstrates that kind of faith that's expressed in those words. Maybe this morning you would like to demonstrate your faith in those words, and that would be by responding to what Jesus invited people to, and that is to be a follower of his, believing in him and being baptized for the forgiveness of your sins so that he can make you his child. If you would do that this morning, it would be an opportunity, and we'd like to invite you to while we stand and sing our song.